So we are Popcorn Psychology. I am Brittany, and I'm a child therapist.
My name is Ben. I'm an individual therapist.
My name is Hannah, and I'm a marriage and family therapist.
And we, all three of us, are therapists that work out of a private practice in Lakeview neighborhood of Chicago, Art and Counseling Center. And this podcast is basically we watch like popular blockbuster movies through the eyes of a therapist, like things like Star Wars, 50 Shades of Grey, Fatal Attraction, all those gems. Sixth Sense is our first Halloween episode that's coming out this Monday. We're going to do a couple of those for the spirit of Halloween. So basically, today is going to be a much shorter version of what we usually do. We usually talk long-windedly for like an hour and a half.
Or less.
So if we leave things out or we miss stuff that you really liked about the movie we're going to talk about, that's why. We'll probably do a long version of this at some point.
We will definitely do a long version of this. The movie's definitely worth a full examination. And so, amazing psych film.
So today we're talking about Silver Linings Playbook, which I'm assuming most people have seen. And we're going to be talking specifically about bipolar disorder and its presentation in the movie, and also how his family in the movie both, well, I wouldn't say, well, it contributes to his presentation.
No, definitely.
Absolutely.
All right, so we can just jump right into it. So basically the movie, Bradley Cooper's character, Pat, starts off the movie being let out of the hospital AMA, which means against medical advice, right?
Right, which means that his family signed him out despite the doctor saying he is not done with treatment. We do not wish you to do this. This is not advisable. This could go poorly. But the family decided that they wanted to let him out, that they were ready for him to come home.
And I'd say pretty immediately he demonstrates that he was not ready to leave the hospital.
Yes, he's still very clearly manic. Bipolar is, by definition, manifests in by showing alternating two symptoms of depression and mania. I know mania is maybe not as popular a word. Mania is when someone is up. They are either excitable or agitated. They are frequently not in touch with reality. We see with Pat that he gets so manic at times that he gets delusional.
Yeah, and often you don't sleep very much.
Yeah, so he sees, the symptoms we see right away is he's in the car with his mom, they're leaving the hospital, and he will not shut up. Like, a big sign of someone going through what we call a manic episode is what's called pressured speech. It's when you are talking like this, and you're talking really fast, and you're like, can't seem to stop yourself, and it's like, you can't slow down, you're really hard to understand. And so he starts right away telling his mom about his wife, Nikki, and what he's going to do to get her back, and his friend that's in the car, who is also out of the hospital against medical advice. He swerves the car when she's driving, which is very scary. She's screaming. She's clearly, like, nervous and a little scared of him, and that doesn't seem to be deterring him at all. Like, he's still very high and up and happy, even though her whole body is not joining in on that feeling.
Right. Yeah, see, he has no awareness of other people's perception of him, which when someone is in a manic episode, they're not going to be in touch with or able to perceive other people's reactions to them, often because they are dealing with elation or an elevation to the point that they feel great, so they just assume everybody else feels great, and they're going to be talking rapidly, not interested in sleep. And I think the things that we see with him that indicate that he's still in a manic episode right off the bat, not only swerving the car, but then he talks about, I'm going to read all the books on her syllabus, all of them, all the books. And then he proceeds to read an entire novel in one day. That is a hallmark characteristic of a bipolar episode.
For sure. Well, because lack of sleep, like the very clear sign in the movie when it starts is he reads all of Farewell to Arms in one night. He wakes his parents up at 4 a.m. because he can't contain his excitement. And he like proceeds to start yelling about this, I don't know, I don't like this book, but the romance of the book and how horrible it is. He throws the book out of a window, breaks the window, it's the middle of the night. He's already kind of on the bad side of the police because of restraining orders and why he went to the hospital. And so he has no concept of the fact that he's waking up his parents, that he's waking them up for what is arguably a stupid reason, an insignificant reason, that he's causing a disturbance within the neighborhood, that he's doing something that's going to get the cops' attention. Like, none of this is, it's all over his head.
No, he has no concept or awareness of what time it is at all. Mm-hmm. Or that it's improper to wake people up to talk about a 60-year-old book.
Yeah.
And it's also pretty clear that even though he's been in the hospital and most likely has been taught ways of how to calm himself down, of how to stop what he's doing and consider it, he's not using any kind of coping skills. He's full on having a manic episode and just rolling with everything that's happening.
Right, and something else they show us right away, probably in the first 3 minutes of the movie, is that he is not taking his medication.
Yeah. Yep. I guess that's really good to note, is this is a presentation of bipolar disorder where someone's not taking care of it. They're not listening to psych recommendations because he left the hospital. He's not taking his meds. He's very resistant with his therapist, like constantly like arguing with him about what's going on. Even though he's agreeing that he has bipolar disorder, he's still like, yeah, but I don't got to do all that stuff about it. I'm just going to work out
Excelsior.
And run around the neighborhood and read my wife's syllabus and I'm going to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's very, very clearly manic. And when you see someone who is in a manic episode, it can be dangerous for them. It can be dangerous for their family because they can lose touch with reality real quick. And as we see in the movie, he gets really elevated to the point where he gets angry and loses control. And it's an important thing to watch for when you're dealing with somebody who's prone to manic episodes, is that they can become happy, but they can alternatively get just as elevated on the anger side.
Yeah, it's not always, mania is not always like pumped up, hyperactive kind of excitement. It can always, it's, I guess what I would describe it as exaggerated reactions in any way. Like really, really angry about something they shouldn't be angry about. Like a good example is when he goes to his therapist's office, which is a horrible thing his therapist does, is he plays his wedding song, which is a clear trigger for his trauma and his mood swings. And his therapist plays it in the waiting room with other people around who are like children and stuff. And he has a bananas response. Like he's throwing stuff around.
Well, because he's having a manic episode and then he gets triggered 100% and and gets upset and throws stuff on the floor. And so this is a really good example of what not to do as a therapist. A lot of times what you would do with somebody who has a trigger like that is you would start out by, we're going to play the song for like 30 seconds in the office, just you and me, and I want to see how you feel after that. And then we're going to play a minute of the song. How did that feel? What did you do? Do you need to do deep breathing? You don't have him come to the office after he left the hospital when he wasn't supposed to and play the song in the entire
office.
Just
to see how it goes.
No. Just to see what happens.
Yeah, no, I don't think any therapist would have ever done that.
Like, that therapist could have got sued by the other clients in that office if he had hurt anyone.
Should have.
Because he was throwing stuff around. He was acting so hostile. And then he walks in the office and he goes, I'm not the explosions guy. I don't explode like my dad. After he very clearly just exploded in the lobby. Which I think is another key thing that he does throughout the movie that's very accurate, which is he has no insight into, he doesn't connect his actions and his behaviors to, one, consequences, and two, to what's going on with him.
So when we talk about bipolar, there's different types of bipolar disorder, right?
Yes, correct.
So there's bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. When we talk about bipolar 1, that's your classic when you see two distinct mood states that last for a period of 2 weeks each at least, where you see depression and mania. There's also bipolar 2 where you might see long periods of depression and then infrequent but definitely present episodes of hypomania. But what's the difference between mania and hypomania?
Well, hypomania is kind of like it's like a average baseline moods here, like you or I. Mania is all the way up here, and hypomania is like halfway there, or maybe a little higher than that, where you're kind of just like a little pumped up all
the
time.
Bouncy.
Like you have like goals that you go after, and you like maybe you only do that thing that you like every day for like a month, and you're like a little too focused on that, and you just kind of. But you can coast at hypomania for a while because mania.
Sure.
It's so exhausting after a while that you, because you don't sleep for days maybe, so that you have to crash because you just can't maintain it. But hypomania, you can kind of maintain for a lot longer. So people can be hypomanic for a long time.
Which is where I would argue we see Pat in this movie is in a state of hypomania.
Yeah.
Generally, the defining characteristic between hypomania and mania isn't just that it's sort of mania light. It's that when someone reaches full-blown mania, the likelihood that they need to be hospitalized is extremely high. If someone is in a full manic state, they are not going to be in touch with reality. They're going to be engaging in a range of symptoms that include spending money, not sleeping, engaging in risky behaviors, possibly thinking they can do things or have delusions of grandeur that they wouldn't normally have. But when someone's in a hypomanic state, which is where I argue where we see Pat, he's probably not dangerous to anybody at that point in time, at least not if he's not agitated.
But he's very easily agitated.
But he's very easily agitated. But I do want to state the one thing I saw in this movie that I want to make sure is clear is that having a mental illness does not make you
violent.
Any more likely to be violent than anybody else.
No, it doesn't.
And I would argue
Pat,
in this movie, what makes him violent, is
okay.
that his environment is also not conducive to him being a stable person.
Right. It's his environment is chaotic. He grew up with a father who got kicked out of the Eagle Stadium, and the Eagle Stadium has a jail in it. You can't even go there.
I didn't know that.
They were like, you're too intense for that, brah.
You're too intense for this most intense stadium in the NFL that has its own jail.
Yeah. Yeah, and so he's in a situation in the movie where he has parents that are clearly not understanding what he's going through and how to manage it. They're, because even
so,
in the,
yeah, go ahead. Yeah. So as the marriage and family therapist, what's really clear to see is that they don't talk about mental illness in their family. They ignore it. They kind of, the environment that Pat is in, he's not able to get any validation or understanding about what he's going through. Like, even when he comes back from the hospital, his dad just says to him, so you're good now? So you're good.
You're
what
okay,
does
right?
that mean? Like,
Mirren
he was in the hospital.
But I think that's a very clear case of people thinking of mental health like they think of physical health.
Yeah.
Like, you had a broken bone, you go to the hospital, they put you in a cast, you out, you good.
Or yeah. One thing that really bothers me with bipolar is, they're prone when they're manic to not take meds.
It's a very common. It's very common.
Very, very common because they feel great. Why do I
yeah.
need meds? But what people miss is that taking psych meds is not like taking an antibiotic. With an antibiotic, you get a course, you get a dose, you take it for 2 weeks, you're better, you're done, you're good. It doesn't work that way. You have to maintain a certain level. With bipolar, what we're doing is we're correcting an imbalance in the chemicals in your brain. And if you're taking meds to balance that out, level it out so that you are able to behave in a rational, meaningful manner, then you have to keep taking those in order to keep getting that result. And
yeah.
when people go into manic episodes, which they can even when they're on a medication, it's likely yep. to be blunted. The peaks and valleys won't be as high, but they're still more likely at those moments to stop taking medication.
Yeah, because they feel good. And also I think, which he really talks about, which I think is important to note about bipolar is, a lot of people, well not, I shouldn't generalize like that. Many people who have bipolar disorder really like the personality traits of being a little manic or hypomanic. Because they can be very productive. They don't have to sleep. I listened to an interview where a guy had been a stockbroker and was fully, not unmedicated as bipolar, and he was killing it because he didn't need to sleep. He would work later than everybody, and he would just go, go, go. And you feel really confident as well with a lot of people who have the manic.
Oh, tons of confidence.
So he's just, like, getting it. But you can only maintain that for so long. And so what he says in the movie is, I don't like taking the meds. They make me feel groggy. I don't feel like myself, which is a very common complaint, which is why a lot of people don't like taking them, because they won't feel like themselves, especially like Pat, where you've been unmedicated, untreated bipolar for like 30-plus years. You're used to that being your personality, so you don't feel like yourself anymore. So that's something that people will have to really work through and get over, not get over, but kind of grieve their old personality and maybe what they accomplished, even though it was making them unwell or unsuccessful in certain parts of their life.
Oh, absolutely. You definitely have to grieve. Grieve is like the exact right word, because people get used to it. Imagine being injured for a long time, and then if you're a runner and you got injured and you can't run for 6 months and you've been feeling down and bummy about it, then all of a sudden you get healed and you can start running marathons immediately. That's what people who've been depressed and switch into a manic episode feel like. Like, I feel great now. I can do all the things that mm-hmm. I used to do. And you see it in creative folks. I know there's one author. I wish I could remember the name. But I know he wrote most of his works in a 900-page manuscript he wrote in a 4-day manic episode and used that for his career. So people need to mourn that.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think the other thing that Pat really has a hard time with, which I think is a part of being in his family, is has a really hard time accepting that he has bipolar disorder.
Or
a mental illness at all. I remember he says something to the psychiatrist like, yeah, well, I have that diagnosis for right now. Yeah. It's like, buddy, like, there's a really good chance that you're going to have this diagnosis for the rest of your life. And that you're going to have to find a way to either grieve who you thought you were going to be and be able to accept that now there's something else about you, and we have to learn how to accept that part in order to be able to start recovery and to be able to maintain a manageable life in a way.
So what are some of the things you see in his family as a family therapist that you would want to make sure are getting treated?
Well, there's so many. Communication is very poor. They don't really talk to each other about anything besides the Eagles, it seems like.
They talk about the Eagles. They talk about dad's remote controls.
The remote controls.
They talk about people. They gossip a lot.
I think one thing that is really clear is that they don't have any information about mental health in general. So I think part of what I would do is what I saw is that with psychoeducation, I think we would find out that the dad most likely has some kind of mental illness, if not bipolar disorder as well.
I would gamble on OCD and bipolar.
But for him, he's in an environment where everybody does what he wants, so he doesn't have to make any changes. He doesn't have to change anything.
Well, they thrive in the old school mentality in that household, which is he's the dad, so he's in charge. Mom just makes sure everybody's cool and everybody's well fed, and she's making you homemades and all that stuff. And you don't really challenge the dad because it's very hush hush. And I think they do what I think a lot of more old school mentality is where they treat Pat like a behavior problem. Like he's still a little kid and they can overpower him and like use punitive efforts to make him act correct. Like when he's having these manic episodes where he's clearly not there, especially when he's looking for his wedding video and he's so upset and he's screaming, his dad just keeps yelling at him, why can't you stop? Shut up. Stop. Stop.
They're just,
screaming at him.
Yeah.
And then physically overpowering him at a certain point. And it's like, that's not what he's about. Like, you can't overpower a mental health issue. You're not going to out-strengthen him right now. And he's not going to just snap out of it because you're physically coercing him, you're telling him to shut up, because it's not a behavioral issue. He's not choosing to behave this way. It's his mental health.
And I think it's also upsetting in a way that the hospital doesn't do anything with the family.
Well, maybe they tried and they were like,
maybe
we don't got to go to no family sessions. We good.
Yeah, well, probably, which is a bummer. But it just seems like there's just no information about bipolar disorder. What do you do when Pat starts acting like this? How can you talk to him? They really know how to just ramp everything up and make everything harder and really create a crisis.
I agree. I think the thing that bothers me the most about the way the family responded to him is that something I see in clients, I work with bipolar a lot. It's one of my areas of focus, so I really am passionate about it. And one of the things that I see a lot is that when someone has that diagnosis, their family takes away their ability and right to have regular emotions and will start ascribing those to bipolar, and then we'll
you're having an episode.
Like, instead of just like a bad, like a hard day.
Or like something
is sad, and we're just sad.
And in this movie, the cop does it a lot, and the parents are like, oh, you want to go back to Baltimore?
Threatening him to go back to the hospital when he's clearly distressed is like, what's that supposed to accomplish? It's again thinking you can intimidate the issue, and that whole, like, he's choosing to act out, and so you need to, like, alpha dog him.
Yeah.
Which is very insensitive on top of everything else.
Absolutely.
But I think this movie is a good example of just a family that's very much not educated about mental health. They're not interested in being educated about mental health. And
Absolutely.
They just think that you can suck it up and get better if you just wanted it enough or decided to be better.
Absolutely. But I think one thing that I really liked about the way this movie presented it is that they do go through a distinct moment where they show Pat has this crisis. He has a flashback to when his wife cheated on him.
Yeah.
And that's when he accidentally hits his mom and gets in the fight with his dad.
Mm.
But after that moment, Pat decided to start complying with treatment.
Yep.
Yeah.
That, I thought, was a great representation of how things go. He starts taking his lithium. He starts taking his antidepressant, which is the general recommended course for bipolar disorder, is to have a mood stabilizer medication to control the ups and a antidepressant to control the downs.
I had a client once tell me that you need one med to give you a floor and one med to give you a ceiling, and then you can kind of just hang out.
Yeah,
correct.
That sounds right.
It's not going to completely smooth out the peaks and valleys, but it's going to shrink the range to a more manageable range of emotion.
And I think also what's good is the therapist doesn't just rely entirely on his meds. Like, he tells him, you need to have a strategy. You need to know what to do when you're upset, because you can't wait until it's happening. You have to have a plan before, which is something we do a lot in therapy. Like, what's your plan when this happens? Because we don't want to treat people like being better in mental health isn't not having any feelings or any experiences. It's learning how to better cope when they happen. And I always tell people, it's like when you have a basketball game, you don't wait till the game to like dribble and to shoot and practice all this stuff. You have to go to practice first,
right?
To get, so it's muscle memory for when the game happens. So you have to practice coping skills. You have to have a strategy before the big event, whatever that's going to be, before the distressing situation. You can't just wait until you need it and try to use it because you're too upset. You're not. You're seeing red. Like you're not going to get there.
Right.
Definitely. So when we're talking about bipolar, what's the recommended course of treatment?
Well, what you said, medication and seeing a therapist and kind of really working on how do you know when you're starting to get up? A lot of times I do mood scaling, which is like 0 to 10, like whatever their definition of a 0 is. And that could be really depressed or that could be them at like a normal baseline. And then a 10 is whatever that feels like for them. Like does their heart start to race? And that's like a 3. And then they start to get like a headache at like 5. And then what's the point of no return? Like a 6 or 7. And how do you know bodily that you're at a 6 and a 7? And part of it too is being really honest with yourself about what's your point of no return. Because some people like to wait until they're at like a 7 or 8 and then be like, I'll start using a coping skill now. But if you're out of practice, if you're new to all of it, maybe you have to start at a 3. And that might not feel, you might not feel proud of that. You know,
yeah.
But
right.
That might be where you have to start practicing so that you have that strength, that muscle memory to use coping skills when you're higher up on there. Because when we're all distressed, I mean, we've all been in situations where your heart's going, adrenaline's going, you're really upset. A lot of us revert back to probably very childish behaviors still, no matter how old you are.
Absolutely.
When you're in that state, so imagine you have mental health issues on top of that, you know, and then trauma on top of that as well. Like, you're not going to be able to like kill it in the moment in terms of managing yourself.
No, so we have to work on mood recognition and mindfulness so you're aware of when your moods are starting to change, what the symptoms are, and you want to intervene earlier. You teach intervention earlier, like Brittany's saying, like, okay, you need to scale these moods and track them so that you know when to intervene, because if you intervene earlier, it's easier to control. I like to think there's a lot of physics in dealing with mental health is like, okay, how do we apply the basic principles of physics? If this object gets in motion and gains momentum, it's going to be harder to stop. So let's intervene earlier.
And there's also a really good chance that when we get more upset, that so we have our baseline, and you should be doing regular coping skills at that point. So usually when you get up to here, you need to do more than just a couple. So you need to add some extra things in order to do. But if you aren't practicing any regular coping skills at this level, what is the chance that all of a sudden you're going to be able to do, you know, 10 different things when you're up here? It's just not likely at all. And so that's one of the things that I, especially with people, really with anybody, trying to help them really find coping skills. One of the first things I do with people.
So when we're talking about bipolar, we see recovery if someone refuses meds. Are we likely to see recovery or management of bipolar without medication?
I don't know. I mean, I think if you're treating someone who's refusing to take meds, I think it's more going to have a plan for when do you need to go to the hospital every once in a while, and is that something you're okay with, and having a plan for that, and you might need maybe more supervision or supports that will help you dictate if you need to go to the hospital.
All right.
Oh. Okay.
Take your time. Do your thing.
Okay.
I thought you were telling us at that time.
What you were talking about before, where we were talking about how you have the levels.
Yeah.
One of my best friends is bipolar, and she told me years ago. She said that she didn't know she was manic until her kids said she was nice.
Oh.
So she said her little boys would go, Mom, you are so fun, or you're really nice. And she'd go, oh, God, I'm doing something wrong.
But that's a good indicator.
And so she said, then I'd look around and realize I'm in a convenience store buying them every candy on the shelf.
Yeah.
So she would, that's how hers manifested.
Yeah.
Yep.
But she couldn't identify it from her personal body, but she could only do it if someone pointed out.
Mm-hmm. And that sometimes is the first step, like needing, because you might, like in this movie, Pat is talking to people who are clearly very scared of him. He goes to the school and talks to that woman from the school, and she's like trying
terrified.
To like get in the
terrified.
Building. She's
terrified.
Like cowering from him, and he's like, "Hey, girl, I've got it all figured out. I'm working out. I'm reading all the books. It's gonna be so great, girl. It's gonna be
work.
So great." And
I'm
she's like, she's so clearly terrified, and he has no insight. And so sometimes, if you start from that point where you can't really see it, you might have to rely on external factors, like, "Do I spend a lot of money? Am I, like, your behaviors that other people recognize?" Like, he's living at home, so you might integrate his family into therapy and be like, can you signal to Pat? Is there a signal you could give to Pat that he'll not freak out about, that lets him know, hey, you're getting up there. And that might be where it starts until he can stabilize enough to maybe have better insight and to be in therapy enough to have better insight. Because what's really hard here is, like you said, Hannah, is he's still struggling to accept that he has a mental health disorder. And so that's the biggest step as well, is recognizing that you're going to have to work at it, and that's okay.
Right, accepting it. Like, your friend probably has, like, oh, no, you know, you're fun, Mom. Like, when someone's bipolar, they might get reinforced for being in the manic or hypomanic state, because people are going to be like, oh, you're awesome. Like, particularly if there's somebody who is still, like, engaging in going out to parties or being involved in a social group, like, they might become the life of the party now, and, like, they might be the one who's, like, really fun to be around and get reinforced for it, which makes it hard to treat if they are not medicated. We kind of got away from that, but from my point of view with bipolar, you can treat it you can treat the symptoms without medication, and clients have the right to decide if they want medication or not. You as a clinician have to decide if you are able to treat them if they're not medicated. That's for you to decide what your experience level is. And clients need to be aware that if they're not complying with all treatment recommendations, therapists do have the right to go, you know, I can't treat you if you're not following recommendations. But it's my general opinion that it works, and the research backs this, is that for bipolar, you really want to see them do both, like the psychiatrist recommended. You need to take your meds and have a strategy. You need to do therapy and
medication. I think the therapy part is, so the other part of being a therapist is, part of my job is to help you identify those things, but then also to be like, hey, you see me once a week, and something's going on. There's something going on today.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's part of my job, is to also be someone else that you see on a regular basis who knows what it looks like, because I've been working with you for a while, and who has identified all of these different things that show that something has changed.
I would argue that I don't know if he could be unmedicated in the environment that he's in. That family is so next level, in terms of aggro they get with him when he's clearly already pumped up.
Exactly.
The fact that his dad, when he's finally starting to stabilize and make better choices, his dad puts that huge bet based on his behavior, his outcome at that dance contest. His dad's like, our whole restaurant money, all of our life savings is dependent on you getting a 5 in this dance contest. The one thing that you've been doing for yourself that's a positive outside of us. Like, putting that pressure on, I'm surprised he did that well at that. But at that moment, he was medicated, which made a difference.
Yeah.
But his family not respecting that and not keeping good boundaries about that and not really seeming to be able to model coping skills themselves. Like, they're yellers. His dad's an explosive person. His dad has a lot of unrealistic expectations of him and wants him, like, his good luck charm stuff, and like, you need to be here on these days. I don't really care what you're doing because I need you.
Right. It seemed like the dad trying to build a relationship was never purely motivated by the dad wanting to build a relationship with his son. It was always tied into his obsessions and compulsions about the gambling. And that was sad. And I think the saddest part for me with watching the family happened actually before they did the big bet, was when they went to the game and everybody got arrested. And I know Hannah has some things she wants to say about that. But when the dad starts yelling at him and having his own crisis because the Eagles lost because they got in a fight and weren't at the game, and putting all of that on him and all that big loss that set up the bet, for me that was the saddest part, because dad went through a crisis and no one
And he wasn't demonstrating anything. How to manage it either. He was showing him the way you handle a crisis is by wigging out, blaming other people, yelling, and not having any ownership of yourself.
Right, and no one in the family checked him. No one. Everyone, like, kind of turned to Pat, like, what happened at the game? Like, hold on, though. Like, dad's over here having a crisis, like, placing blame for things that aren't even rational on someone who's ill right now, and that's not fair. But I know that you definitely had some thoughts about that game.
So, when they go to the game, the psychiatrist is there, or the therapist. And their initial reaction, which is, in this field, we're not allowed to walk up to people that we see, because then they have to explain who we are to someone else.
And that's breaking confidentiality.
So that's a HIPAA violation.
And like $1 million fine.
Yeah. So they do that part right, where Pat approaches him and says, hey, how are you? But the fact that the psychiatrist hangs out with them and drinks with them and gets into that fight and then goes to his house, all completely unethical.
Yeah.
Those are things that is a boundary crossing, especially with somebody who already has a hard time with boundaries and respecting his therapist in the first place and really having buy-in for treatment, to have him there and to have him also engaging in the same kind of shit behavior as everybody else. Trying really hard not to curse a lot. If you listen to our podcast, you know that that's very hard for me. So that whole interaction. And then, again, in the movie, they don't show what happens after that with their relationship. There is a really good chance that that relationship is now broken and that now he has to maybe find another therapist.
It would be just
as unethical for that therapist to continue to see him mm-hmm. after that happens.
Yeah, and the therapist goes to the dance competition. That's a judgment call, but given the already transgression of like being in the house, being drunken in the fight, it's so many.
Well, it's like what Hannah said. Like, Pat's already having a hard time respecting boundaries, like getting people's personal space. Like, we're not even going to talk about him and Tiffany, Jennifer Lawrence's character,
because
that
is a
we'll have to wait for the full podcast
mess. But and whatever her deal is. But he's already having a hard time being appropriate and respecting boundaries and reading other people and reading the room. And so for his therapist to not keep those lines very clear, like, he's the kind of client that you have to keep very strict boundaries with for their own good, because you're modeling for them this is how you behave in this situation with this kind of person. And also you don't want to confuse them, because a lot of people – I think that's still something that's really misunderstood. I mean, the amount of movies and TV shows where therapists sleep with their clients makes me crazy. There's clearly a lot of misunderstanding still in, like, the media about the rules around therapists and their clients and what they're allowed to do and not allowed to do and what's really, really inappropriate and takes advantage of the power dynamic of a therapist and a client.
Yeah, I absolutely abhor that. It's... Particularly as a male therapist, if I have a female client, I feel like I have to maintain extra boundaries that mm-hmm. I don't feel like they violate or threaten the relationship at all, but I have to be extra mindful about not doing so, because I know that I have more power, but I don't want it to be perceived in any way like I would ever, ever cross that boundary line that they are seen as any kind of partner to me in any way. Like, they're a client, and I don't know a therapist that has crossed that boundary, but you see it in TV all the time.
Like, if you think it's like 80% of therapists bone down with their clients, the way that the media presents it, and it just it makes my heart hurt.
Yeah. Like, should people be sterilizing their couches, or, you know, like, it's but it doesn't happen. Like, if you look at the ethical violation chart, even they do it over periods of, I think, 2 years during the licensure period. In the entire state, I think there were 2 complaints of that, and there were, like, all the rest of the issues were there's a couple confidentiality violations, and then more were people didn't get their CEUs. But the way TV represents it, like, this is happening all the time, is blatantly false.
So I would say, are there anything else we noticed that was very clear? But I think what they do really well in this movie, which isn't talked about a lot when you see mood, because mood's usually shown in movies and TV shows just like up and down. Yeah. I think what they really show well in this movie is more of what we call the delusional aspect of bipolar sometimes.
Yeah.
Which, and by that I mean all the fantasy thinking he has about his wife and getting back together with her. Like, if I get in shape and if I read all these books and if I get my job back, like Nikki, which is his wife's name, like, I can get all this together with no concept of the fact that she's already living with the other guy she was cheating with, that she's clearly scared of him. She has a restraining order against him. He doesn't even talk to her. That's just, like, non-consequential to him in his life.
Right. All right, so we've about reached our time. So do we have final thoughts on this movie?
It's good.
Yeah, it is good. And I think what was interesting is I saw the movie before I was in the mental health field, and then I saw it after I was in the mental health field and watched it as a therapist. And after working with people who struggle with bipolar disorder, they do such a good job of showing what the struggle looks like for somebody who has bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
They're really probably one of the best that I've seen, besides Infinitely Polar Bear, which not that many people have probably seen, but besides that movie. So I love this movie, and I would watch it a bunch.
Yeah, I think it's the most accurate representation of bipolar I have ever seen in a film, and they cover the aspects of it from... depression to mania to covering the psychotic features that can occur, but they also cover, like, the medication recovery. It's just beautifully done. Bradley Cooper did an excellent, excellent job. And I watched, just when I watched it again, there's a big documentary at the end of it about the movement it started and how many people wrote letters to Bradley Cooper and the director and Jennifer Lawrence for representing it so well and making it accessible to people. And I really love this movie for that.
I really like it, too, for all the reasons you guys said. But also I think that it showcases so much how your family and their attitudes towards mental health, especially if you live with them still, have such a big impact in how in your prognosis and how well you do. Because I work with a lot of kids. And a lot of times, maybe the kid's the first time anyone's ever been in mental health treatment. And so I work with a lot of parents who don't have any knowledge of it just because it's the first time they've encountered it, or they don't get it, or maybe it has been in the family, but everyone doesn't talk about it. And so it's not really the weight of that isn't really portrayed in a lot of movies. It's usually like the person's individual journey. And so recognizing that your family and their attitudes and your environment, basically, the nurture part of nature versus nurture is so demonstrated here. And I think the only really final thought we haven't talked about yet, is the fact that this has the myth of love will heal your mental health. That's our one critique about this movie, which is like Benny and June, other movies do this too, where it's like once you find your person, your lobster, that all your mental health stuff is just going to be like fine, especially since they're both clearly two arguably unstable people. But they good because they're in love.
But we will definitely cover that when we do the full episode, so be sure to tune in to our channel. Find us on Facebook at Popcorn Psychology, or see us on Twitter at Popcorn_Psych. We are on every major podcast app as Popcorn Psychology. So please
And we cover a wide range of topics. Like, this is probably the most mainstream movie we've done, because we do a lot more of, like, Star Wars, Harry Potter, Fatal Attraction, 50 Shades of Grey. We've done all the big ones so far.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is the
first always take suggestions.
Oscar winner we did.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thanks, guys.